Session number 11952, Rule 6.
Mr. Roselle, Reel 6. You were telling me about Captain Charles.
Yes. Of course, this is going back to England. Whilst we were in England, our service caps, the khaki caps before the steel helmets came in, they had a steel spring around the crown to keep the thing taut. Captain Charles had a soft hat and it was bastion on the side, and we wanted them like that, and some bright spark thought of taking the spring out of the hat, which made it all loose, and then we could punch it in so it looked something like the hat of Captain Charles. This spread throughout the company, and we went on parade the first time. The regimental sergeant major, he was absolutely furious, and told us all, after the parade broke up, we were all to go to the quartermaster stores, pay for a new cap. One Captain Charles was enough in the battalion.
He knew what we were doing, you see. I remember that.
Anyway, Captain Charles, when we first got to France, he was slightly wounded and went back, of course. And for the rest of the war, as far as we knew, he was the transport officer at Calais, or Dover, not Dover, Calais, Boulogne. So he had what we called a jammy job. You were asking about the officers. I think we had some darn good ones, because in the trenches it was a great leveller. There was no class or rank even, because you were all in the same boat, and that made for a closer connection between the ranks. The same applied to the NCOs, because we'd been told in England that once you were an NCO, you hadn't to sort of cavort with your privates. You had to more or less keep aloof. But of course that all went west once you were in the line.
Now, when you lost casualties, presumably you had reserves come up to take their place.
Yes.
What sort of chaps were they who came into your platoon?
Well, some of them, they were all enthusiastic in those days, I must say. But some of them were, they'd only been in the army for a few weeks. They'd been shown how to use a rifle and so on, because we were getting short of men at that time. And I remember draft, as we called them, coming to our platoon when we were in the craters, after when it settled down a bit, and they came from the Channel Islands. And I remember we were veterans by this time, but of course they were newcomers, and if they saw a body which was hanging over the parapet or something, you know, you could see them shrink from it, and we knew that they were suffering like we did at first. And I remember this same draft, by the next morning, we had about six of them come to our platoon, by the next morning, four of them had been killed. And I thought to myself then, they'd come all the way from the Channel Islands, patriotic boys. They hadn't even seen a German. They hadn't even seen daylight in the trench, because it all happened. They came up in the dark and they were killed in the dark. That's the sort of thing that happened. But you hadn't to think of it too much. You hadn't to dwell on that sort of thing. Otherwise, it could have been depressing.
Roughly, how long did it take before they grew accustomed to trench life?
Well, I should imagine 8 weeks. But if you had something like the craters, that speeded it up. See, living among the casualties and knowing you were there and you had to carry on with it. So you came out of an affair like that as a sort of veteran. You weren't just callous, but you didn't let things deeply affect you too much. I mean, we had to bury our dead behind the trench at night when it was dark, and you can imagine we our own comrades, and we had to lay them in a shell hole. If we had waterproof sheets to spare, we covered them with that. Other than that, we had to put the earth on them, and we would, for our own convenience, we would put as many in the shell hole as we could, cover them over. And of course we hadn't done with them even then, because if there was a fierce bombardment next day or a few days, they were disinterred. That was the war.
Was there any difficulty in these new men gaining acceptance into the unit now that they were veterans?
No, because we felt sorry for them and kindly towards them, you know. For instance, I don't know whether I told you before, but we had a very upmarket battalion come in. They were the Inns of Court anyway, they came in, and they came in loaded with goodies from probably Fulton and Mason's or Harrods, and we shared all these goodies and we felt sorry for them. But I also remember two Cockney boys of ours who were sanitary men. In other words, they looked after the latrines, dug the latrines, put the empty biscuit tins in them and so on. And of course, they called them pioneers. Originally, we called them sanitary men. So the pioneers of the new battalion that was coming up for instructions with us went to the pioneers, and of course I overheard them talking. They said, what will we do, you see? And they said, well, we can't do anything now, the sanitary man said, until it's dark. After it's dark, he said, we get over the back of the trench, he said, and your mate hands you the tins and you empty them in the nearest shell hole, cover it with chloride of lime and put it back and go on to the next one. They said, oh, we don't do that. We're pioneers. We build bridges and make roads. And I remember this Cockney fellow saying, you don't do that in this war. He said, you empty the latrine tins. But anyway, the next night I saw them going round, and they were doing it just as well as our people were.
Now, you say you, after Loos, your next move was to the Somme.
Yes.
How did you actually make that move? Did you march?
No, we marched, yes. And it was very hot, and we had some... I think we were a bit short of time, because we did quite long marches, and it was hot weather. But actually, most of us were, by this time, we were tough and fit, you know. And we didn't know we were going to the Somme, and we weren't told or anything of that. And we marched, and we came to Elbeur, and we were billeted in the empty. Well, it was a bit of a. They were all. The town was ruined, really, but we were in the ruined houses and so on, behind the line. And of course our battalion didn't go over the top on the 1st of July. We went over on the 7th of July.
Do you remember how many days it took you to get to the Somme?
No, I should think it was perhaps four days.
And other than Albert, do you remember anything about the route?
No.
Did you do this march in platoon column or company column?
In company column, yes. Mm. Company column. And we did 50 minutes marching and 10 minutes rest on the side of the road, you know. And one company would lead one day and another company another day in the corps. And of course, most of the company officers had, the commanding company also had a horse, and the colonel had a horse and the adjutant. And he used to ride in with one company for so long, then come back and be in front, because he used to yell out, "Sing up, sing up." And of course, some of our songs were a bit ribald, and if there was a particularly fruity one, you know, he would laugh. And when he was walking in front of the battalion and for a rest from riding, he would usually say to the adjutant, you know, he called him Bobby, "Did you teach them that one, Bobby?" That was a kind, yes.
Did you carry all your equipment in packs, or did you have baggage wagons?
No, we had baggage wagons, but they only carried the blankets. We put them in rolls of tin, they carried the blankets. We carried all our own kit, which weighed about 60 pounds, and if you had any private stuff, of course, that was extra.
But were you marching mainly on roads?
Yes, mainly on roads, because I still, it's a picture I have. I don't know whether most of the poplar trees have gone now, but it was all in those days pave on the floor, and as far as you could see, poplar trees on either side.
How many hours in the day would you actually be marching?
Well, I don't remember now, but I think we would do something like 20 miles in a day.
So you'd be on the move for at least 6 or 7 hours?
Yes.
What about feeding? How was that done when you were on a march?
Well, we had our cookers with us, and we had our rations given out before we started, the rations you could carry in your, like bread, cheese and so on, tins of butter, tins of jam, you carried that. But in fact, that was one of my worries as an NCO, was dishing out the rations, because a tin of jam would come up, you see, three tins perhaps, if you had 11 men when we were, when we first arrived, a section was 15 or 16 men, but afterwards it never got above, say, 11, 12, usually about 9. And you'd say, so-and-so, that's your tin of jam. If they were all there, okay. But if some were in the line, when you were in the line, some were sleeping, some were somewhere else. And the result was, when you were trying to sleep, somebody would come and say, "Whose tin of jam am I in?" You know, this sort of thing. And you'd saw up the meat, because we had raw meat sent up in the early days, saw it up with a jackknife into portions, and you'd have to leave it there if they weren't all around. The same thing applied, you see, but if anybody complained to the officer, of course, whatever happened, you were responsible for position out their rations, so you always got it. That was one of my worries. But we managed all right, really.
What kind of food did they serve on the march? Was it mainly soup or stew?
Yeah, stew. We had stew nearly all the time. When we were well behind the lines and were staying, we did have roast, because they'd rigged up a few ovens. But it wasn't very successful, because the meat was just about raw. So we went back to the stew. But of course, when we were behind, the line, if there were any civilian, if we were far enough back there were civilian inhabitants, there was always a couple of old ladies who made eggs and chips. So we went off the army rations and had eggs and chips. We had the bacon in the morning, our bread and bacon and fried bread, because it was lovely bacon in those days. But we didn't have so much of the stew.
You mentioned carrying private kit along with official. What kind of private kit did people have?
If you'd had a cake sent from your mother, for instance, you'd dish some of it out among your pals, and the remainder you would carry with you. And some people sent them tin stuff, you know. And I had a little Tommy cooker that burnt a coil of methacetylated wax. You put it underneath and you could boil a tin, but of course you had to carry it. It was all just made of tin, very light.
Sort of camping equipment.
Yes. I carried that for quite a while. We carried our souvenirs. For instance, if you got any souvenirs like Mausers or guns, and if they got helmets, they carried them with them until they could usually sell them. We couldn't get them home, but people who weren't in the line, like the Army Service Corps or the Medical Corps, we'd meet them in the estaminets and they would buy these. Well, not only buy, I suppose, give you a beer or something. I remember getting a Mauser from a German officer. He was dead, but it was hanging up alongside his machine gun. And it was a beautiful thing. And there were refills of the magazine and so on. Well, I brought that out, carried it for quite a while, but there was no hope of getting it home. I'd like to have kept it. So the quartermaster of our battalion offered me, I think, about 70 francs for it. So I gave it to him. They were able to get stuff home, I think. And we spent it in my section on a night out in the estaminet. That's the sort of thing we carried other than our kit, you see. Of course, when we were going over the top, we usually had extra bandoliers of ammunition, as well as our pouches. Our colonel ordered us to carry 2 Mills bombs, one in each trouser pocket. The idea being, if 50 men got there, you've got 100 bombs, you see. And then, of course, NCO would have a Very pistol and cartridges, which was all extra. Somebody would have wire cutters. So you were well loaded down. Others would have a bundle of, fasten it to their back, a bundle of sandbags, a roll of sandbags. And so we went over really weighing down.
You said about getting cake sent from home. Was the mail reasonably reliable?
Very good. It was very good, considering. I mean, I asked my mother to send me a protractor, a tiny protractor that I could put in my pocket, because I was a sniper. Well, we couldn't do much sniping because everything was flat. But we could send back map references if there was a mortar, a worrying outfit, or a machine gun. So I wanted this to put the map on the fire step and so on. And that was given to me in a letter in the trench an hour before we went over the top on the Somme. The mail came up. So it was really marvellous, you know. And I had papers sent to me. They were about a week late because my mother sent them several days. But it didn't matter to us because dates didn't matter really. And we had the local news.
Did you spend a lot of time writing home?
Not very much. I had no girl. I was my mother. I used to send her a letter once now and again, but mostly those cards that you crossed out the word in it didn't apply. I am well, I received your parcel, I am in hospital, and so on, you see. Well, I sent those, and of course when I was on leave I was told about it. But I said, well, we didn't have much time to write, really. But anyway, we got green envelopes that were not censored. You got one of those probably about once a month. I think that was about the time I wrote to my mother.
You mentioned sharing out food and so on. Mm. Did you find that generally within a section there would be permanent little groups who always fed together?
Well, you do get that, yes. You get a little crowd together,
little
and share their rations,
up.
Yeah, and share their cigarettes and so on. Yes, you get that. But when we'd had very bad casualties, of course, parcels came up galore, where there was nobody there to receive them. But it was agreed that you would share them out with your platoon, so that cakes and things like that. And it's a funny thing, I never did that. I had something, it was because their family had sent them, and I thought, I can't have those cigarettes. But most of the lads just accepted. I expect I was stupid, but we shared out the cigarettes and everything. And we got letters sometimes from the parents who said, we hoped that anything that came from them you would share out among the comrades, because already there some was in hospital or worse, you see. So that was the accepted thing with parcels when people were casualties.
Did you normally find also that the same people would do the cooking every time? Were there natural cooks in your...
Well, that was something... In England, if a man didn't know his left from his right, they put him in the cookhouse. I noticed a difference when I've been abroad in Germany with our troops now, that they have chefs, qualified chefs, don't they? Anyway, well, they did pretty well, I suppose. It was the same cooks, unless they had any... And they didn't go in the line, they stayed with the transport. The regimental sergeant major stayed with the transport. And after the Somme, the colonels and the captains stayed behind, because, like our battalion, it was absolutely obliterated, no officers came back, and you had no skeleton battalion, you see. Just had, in fact, Arturo Villas. I don't know whether I should tell you about that now. We went over the top, it was 700 yards to go, and I remember we were going over in company line, 2 minutes interval between each line. I went with the headquarter company. The headquarter company had with them the colonel, the adjutant, the snipers, the bombers, and various headquarter people. And just before the first two lines had gone, and our colonel, I was just behind him in the traverse, he stood up on the assault ladder, looked over, and he said, "It's a gift, Bobby." Bobby was the adjutant. Anyway, we went over, and we'd probably been going about 25 yards when I saw the colonel falter, put his arm round his orderly, take a few more steps forward, and he sank to the ground. I heard afterwards that was the end of our colonel. Of course, you can't stay or help or do anything. You must go on in an attack. And I noticed that the first two lines were practically all down, because there was terrific machine gun fire coming from the Jerry's. I came to a road which ran at a slight angle to our line of advance. I noticed that every man that attempted to cross the road went down. It was obvious to me that there was a fixed machine gun or guns firing down the road. And I noticed how deadly, and it was there in front of my eyes, a man would drop, hitting the lower limbs, and in a few seconds, he was cut to pieces. Machine gun's a cutting machine. Anyway, there wasn't exactly a ditch, but a depression at the side of the road, and I scuttled along there until I came to the German wire, which was intact, breast high, and about 20 feet in depth. I dropped into a shell hole under the wire, and I was immediately joined by another man. I hadn't chosen a very deep shell hole, but he was of the opinion, and same as mine, that this attack had failed. And there we were, under the wire. You couldn't possibly get back again in daylight. And in July, it was a long time to darkness.
I was going to ask you what time of day this attack started.
I'm not absolutely sure. I think it was 7 o'clock in the morning. It was early morning anyway, but it wasn't in the dark, July. I think it was about 7. Official histories will know the time.
And you mentioned you were the headquarter company. Was that in the first wave of the companies?
Third wave, yeah. As I said, when I got up, the first two waves were practically all down.
So there'd be two companies ahead, and then...
Yes, and then we went.
And then you went. Were you in the middle between the...
Well, there were two-minute interval between each line. We were all in the same jumping-off trench to start with, the whole battalion. And so there was another line to come after the one I went with, the fourth line.
Roughly, what was the interval between you and the next man on either side of you?
Well, in theory, it was about a yard, so that we would spread 200 yards, a company, you see.
100 men would cover.
Company line, yes. And the Germans knew we were there because they began throwing their potato masher bombs. We called them potato masher bombs because they looked like a... But we were just out of range. We could feel the concussion when they exploded. But provided we kept below, they did us no harm. All we could think of doing was to stay put at the moment. How long we were there is very vague in my mind. It could have been half an hour or an hour. But we looked up every now and again to see how things were going. And one of these times I saw Mills bombs going through the air and the German bombs going back. It was obvious that our men had got in somewhere on the left and were bombing the Germans out. When they got opposite to us, the Germans left the trench and ran back. They were gone in seconds before we could drive at them. So then we went along to the left until we came to where the wire was damaged enough that we could get our prickly way through, and we got in the trench and joined our troops.
Were they chaps from your battalion?
No. They were a county regiment. They were either the Suffolks or the Norfolks or the Middlesex. I got an idea it'd be the Middlesex because they were in our brigade. Probably they were on our left, you see. Anyway, I stayed with them all that day, and when it quietened down, we were standing too in case of a counterattack. But when it quietened down, I went as far as I could along the German trench, each way, looking for... And I couldn't find any fusilier. Anyway, we stayed all that night, standing too, the next day, and we were relieved in the evening. I got a chip from one of the officers to show where I'd been, because you can't wander about at a loose end. They want to know where you've been, you see. Anyway, we went back, and when we got back to the transport, I saw our regimental sergeant major standing on the road. As soon as he saw me, of course, regimentally, "Pull out the 8th battalion." So I went to him, I said, I'm the only one left. It can't be, he said. He said, anyway, the cookers are there, you can get some tea. He said, well, we won't be leaving for quite a while. So that's what happened, and they came down in ones and twos. And when there were no more coming down, we moved back to Elbert, and we spent the night in a place. I remember that clearly because it had a glass roof. It was a ruined hall, and in order to lie down on the concrete floor, we had to clear the broken glass. So I remember doing that. Next day, we moved back to some woods in huts, and we had a roll call. And apparently the colonel had been killed, adjutant was killed, all four company captains were killed. No officers came back. They were either killed or wounded. There was one NCO, that was myself, a corporal, one lance corporal, and 63 privates. That was not unique among the regiments on the Somme. There were many dozens of regiments who found themselves in a like position.
When you were preparing for this attack, before you went over the top on the 7th of June,